hiring and less unemployment. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News. The jobs report this morning shows quite the slowdown last month, with less than half the number of new hires from December.
Fewer jobs than expected were created in January, 143,000. Economists anticipated 170,000 new jobs. The month included winter storms and the California wildfires. However, the unemployment rate declined in January to 4% from 4.1%.
That's Fox's Jenny Casola. The White House just put out a statement that the worse-than-expected hiring underscores the need for President Trump's pro-growth policies. 65,000 federal workers are planning to leave their jobs, taking the president's offer to resign and be paid through September, but more still can. The deadline's been extended to Monday night by a federal judge who will hold a hearing that day to a legal challenge to the Trump offer. There's also a court case being made out of the Trump administration shutting down much of the U.S. Agency for International Development, calling it spending out of control.
Unions for USAID workers are suing. They're alleging a global humanitarian crisis, lost jobs, and diminished national security after DOGE abruptly halted the agency's operations. DOGE, they're outlining a litany of questionable expenditures. This lawsuit claims that President Trump exceeded his authority and only Congress can dissolve USAID or merge it with the State Department.
That's Fox's Jackie Heinrich at the White House. Reuters reports only about 600 essential USAID workers will remain. Nearly 10,000 other staffers will be put on administrative leave. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem will go to Guantanamo today, where the U.S. will house some illegal immigrants arrested in raids and deported. 23 are there already,
including suspected members of the gang Tren de Aragua, a murder suspect and a man officials say admitted to escaping a Venezuelan prison. According to officials, others are accused of intent to commit homicide, robbery, weapons trafficking, and assault.
Fox's Kristen Goodwin. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time to throw out your overpriced big wireless contract. Throw it overboard. You can get an iPhone 14 or a Samsung Galaxy for $0 with a qualifying plan of just $45 a month. Get unlimited talk, unlimited text, 25 gigs of data, mobile hotspot. You get all of it. So get your new iPhone 14 or Samsung Galaxy for $0. Just dial #250, say the keyword Pure Talk, #250, keyword Pure Talk, from Pure Talk, America's wireless company.
He's coming. Here he comes.
Surprise! Your table saw broke. Also, the warranty expired weeks ago, so you need to pay for a new one out of pocket.
At Progressive, we know small business owners don't usually like surprises because they cost you money. But a good surprise that could save you money? Getting a commercial auto quote from Progressive.
Oh, and the replacement part you ordered doesn't fit, so it's completely useless.
What a waste.
Surprise yourself. See if you can save in as little as 7 minutes at ProgressiveCommercial.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
A very happy Friday to you all from the News 11 Information Desk. I'm Scott Gross. The Yuma Crossing National Heritage Area says they admitted over 60,000 visitors last year and provided over 4,000 public tours. They brought in more visitors by expanding historic programs and tours, providing educational school field trips, and hosting more special events.
The new Christmas at the Crossing 3-day event in December, and then we just finished up our Wild West Days event.
There's an almost $9 million investment coming from the Bureau of Reclamation that will help improve the East Wetlands to conserve it for several years to come. And the Yuma City Council has named a new deputy mayor. City Council member Carol Smith is taking over the position after serving on the council for the past 2 years. Smith was voted on by her fellow city council members.
I was incredibly humbled, you know, that my colleagues would entrust me with this role.
Smith will begin her new role immediately and is expected to serve in that role for the next year.
Got a terrific weekend coming for weather. Let's start with 79 and sunny on Friday, 52 Friday night, sunny and 78 Saturday, 53 Saturday night, sunny and 78 on Sunday, 49 on Sunday night.
Investment advisory services offered through CWM, LLC, and SEC Registered Investment Advisor. Welcome to Money Talk with Yuma Investment Group's Tom Rush, founder, wealth advisor, and George Davis Sr. Wealth Advisor.
Hey, Yuma, this is Money Talk. Tom Rush here. Another great day, great Friday in Yuma. We are going to have a special guest on today who's actually going to be calling in from Phoenix, and he's going to be the main speaker out at the Ag Summit, which is in 2 weeks from now. That's going to be a 3-4 day summit out at the college. And he's going to come in and talk about ag in Arizona and I believe some ag in Yuma. So we will get him on the phone here and introduce them.
He's already on.
Oh, hey, George.
Yeah. Hey, good morning.
Hey, good. I didn't realize you're on the phone. So anyways, let me give him the full introduction. George Frisvold is the Bartley Cardone Endowed Chair of Agribusiness, Economics, and Policy at the University of Arizona. So good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I think you have one of the longer titles at the university. Is that true?
I'm also a professor and extension specialist. I didn't want to overburden you too much. It's okay. Pretty long.
Good. It's only an hour show, so I'm glad you're thinking of that. So, but before we get talking about kind of what you do, can you give a little background on yourself and how you got to the position you're in right now?
Sure. I went to school in doing ag and resource economics, University of California. Got my undergrad there, then re-enlisted, got my PhD there, then worked for USDA for 9 years out in Washington, and then a job came up here in Arizona. I'm from the West, so I was looking to get out of Washington and head out west. So I've been at the University of Arizona since 1997.
Okay, great. And so you teach some classes, but you mainly do research, or what exactly do you do?
I have a three-way split. So I do research, teaching, and extension.
Okay.
And so I teach one class on ag policy a year. And outside of that, most of my stuff is my extension activities.
Okay, great. So would this fall under, I know you're going to talk about, you guys got a report out of ag in Arizona. Is that part of the extension side of it or the research?
Yeah. Yep. Well, it's both, because to do good extension work, you know, to answer particular questions, it takes a fair bit of work. It isn't just like looking numbers up somewhere. You've got to do some analysis and number crunching. And that's where the research comes in. And as we'll talk about a little bit later, like we did some work on water productivity, comparing Yuma and southern Arizona to the rest of the Colorado Basin. And that enters in the policy discussions about, you know, well, who should get, you know, the Colorado River water. And it's really important for that work to go through like peer review research. So it isn't just like, well, you're saying, you know, Arizona's more productive because you're from Arizona. And
right.
It's like, well, no, we have other, like, you know, anonymous researchers looking at the research and vetting it.
Yeah.
You know, and that makes it more powerful. It isn't just.
Yeah. I've actually been at a couple events and they touted the fact that the Yuma farmers are very productive with their water and efficient, right? Is that the report you're talking about?
Yeah, well, we did a report on the overall economic contribution of Yuma to not only the Yuma County economy but to the Arizona economy. But let's talk about that water,
okay,
a little bit first. So we were looking at, you know, how agriculture uses water, and you know, how do you measure it being efficient. And you'll hear, you know, I'm sure out in Yuma, you hear people going, why are you growing why are you growing crops in the desert? Hmm. Or why are you growing crops where the water use per acre is so high? Well, the quick answer to why we grow crops in the desert is that people like to eat vegetables in the winter.
Good answer.
Yeah, you know. And the other aspect is that desert agriculture is incredibly productive. I don't think looking at water use per acre is really a good way to look at the issue. Reporters like to look at that because it's easy. You can look that up and there's a number and it's quotable. But what we were looking at is two different things. One is called economic water productivity. So it's like, how many dollars worth of crop do you get per acre foot? And for people who don't know, an acre foot is the standard way we measure water in the United States instead of metric. Basically, it's the amount of water. If you took an acre and you flooded it a foot deep, that's how much water. An acre is about a football field. So that's an acre foot. So one question is, how much crop value do you get per acre foot? Well, in Arizona, in Yuma, it's over $1,500 an acre foot. And across the entire Colorado Basin, both lower basin and upper basin, the average is less than 700.
Wow.
So that means Yuma's water productivity is double the average. And if you look at the median, right, median is half the counties have one value and half the counties have the other. It's only 176. So Yuma's like 7 to 8 times the median for the counties. Another way to look at this also is there's this thing called water footprint. And this is how much water it takes to produce something. And if you go online, there's all these different websites that will tell you the water footprint of, like, if you buy a pizza, how much water was used in producing that pizza? Or if you buy, you know, anything, there's how much water it took to produce it. And so another way we looked at this is we looked at how much water it took to generate $1,000 worth of crops. And again, in Yuma, it takes like 0.6 acre feet, so you know, a little bit more than a half an acre foot to produce $1,000 a crop. The Colorado Basin average is like 1.44, so more than double. So, or another way to look at it, Yuma's water footprint is half the basin average.
Being an economics major and a money guy, it basically means that from a business standpoint, you're better off spending water for the money down here in Yuma than you are in other parts of Arizona, right? Is that what you're saying?
That's because you live here,
yeah.
Tom.
No. But this is exactly true. And also another way to look at it, you know that there's all these debates about, you know, with shortages of the Colorado River, you know, and they're going to renegotiate, you know, the agreements they had the current agreements expire and they're having to renegotiate something new in 2026. All the basin states, you know, California, Arizona, Nevada, and Utah, Colorado, they're all fighting for that Colorado River water.
Right.
And, you know, it's like, who's going to take a haircut? Who's going to lose, you know, their water? And so far, the lower basin, California and Arizona, have taken the biggest hits. Now, this value term kind of tells you, if you take water away from that, you know, that use in that area, what are you giving up in terms of crop value? And what this analysis says is if you took water away from, let's say, the lower basin, it's a lot more productive than the other basin. So you're going to give up more in terms of food production if you take it away from Arizona relative to other places. And if you were going to pick kind of the most expensive place to take it away from in terms of what society would give up, you would go after Yuma.
I see.
But if, you know, if you wanted to do it at least cost, you would go elsewhere. There's about – right now, ag uses about 9.5 million acre feet of water, and there's – like 2 million acre feet elsewhere where the return is $200 an acre foot or less. And Yuma's $1,500 an acre foot.
Now, is that usually like alfalfa or cotton? Or what's the cheapest thing to grow in Arizona?
Oh, in Arizona, again, the field crops are – you know, their costs tend to be lower, but these other areas that are kind of mostly in the upper basin, they're growing like a lot of hay,
okay,
and a lot of field crops, and you know, and again, their gross returns are like 1/7 of what they are in Arizona. And that's 2 million acre feet. That's getting like 1/7 the value of what Yuma's getting. So if you were going to go after, you know, if you're going to figure out where do you cut back without hitting ag, you know, a lot, you would look elsewhere. And again, that's why we went out and had this, like, you know, we send it to kind of scientific journals and had it peer reviewed, because of course people in, you know, the upper basin don't want to look at this and say, oh, well, wait a minute, the kind of like, the implication is that you should leave Arizona alone and go after these other places to get your water cuts.
Right. Well, that's because you're talking logic instead of politics and emotion.
Well, people who have their water, right? People who have their water want to hang on to it. Right?
Sure.
You know, you guys do finance. You have an asset. You know, no one wants someone to come along and say, "Well, we're just going to kind of take that away from you." So, you know, people want to hang on to their assets.
Yeah, we may be small, but we want to exist, and we, you know, and water's our existence. It's their existence too, even if they're not as effective.
So, has this water report been talked about or on the floor of like the House of the Arizona Senate or anything, or not yet?
We know. Well, we've passed it along to people at Bureau of Rec.
Okay.
So Bureau of Reclamation, which is part, even kind of gets the states together to negotiate settlements, so they're aware of it. And I'm also, you mentioned the Southwest Ag Summit, which is February 18th to the 20th, and I'm talking there, and we're going to be releasing our new report, our full report on Yuma Ag then and there, and that's going to have some of the water stuff in it too.
Okay. So really, really, it's not a state issue. It's a BLM, like with federal, right? Is that's who calls the shots?
Of course.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, at the state level, I think people...
Yeah, everyone wants their state to get this.
Yeah, but people, like, even within Arizona, people, you know, kind of know the value of Yuma Ag. And actually, that's what we'll get into the study we did about Yuma Ag. So we estimated that Yuma's Ag's contribution to the state economy was $4.4 billion. And
big sum.
And but an interesting thing about that, about 3.9 is like all the ag stuff and ag support stuff, input suppliers, plus like university linked research in Yuma. So about, you know, 3.9 billion of that 4.4 is kind of farm activities, you know, on farm stuff in Yuma. Mm-hmm. Another quarter of a billion with a B is all the forward link stuff. So like getting stuff from harvest actually to people, because there's a lot of post-harvest stuff they do with the high value stuff in Yuma, you know, that's the, you know, gets the thing, you know, out to the stores. That's another quarter of a billion. Another like 277 million, Yuma generates that much in sales to other counties in Arizona. So, and the vast majority of that is Phoenix. So again, you know, if there's legislators in, you know, Phoenix or people in Maricopa County, and it's like, well, why should we care about Yuma? And it's like, well, Yuma is generating over a quarter of billion in sales in your county, if you're Maricopa County.
So that kind of means I take in the lettuce and putting it through the restaurants and reselling it, kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, again, it's not, there's the on-farm stuff and then like getting it, you know, out to, you know, kind of getting it out to the food service, getting it out to retail.
Okay. So to summarize it all, Yuma is very important for the productivity of food and its efficient water use, is what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah, incredibly efficient water use. I mean, it's off the dial. You know, it's one of these things where with a lot of Yuma ag stats, anytime I look something up, I do a double take. It's like, wait, this has got to be like an Excel mistake.
Typo, yeah.
You know, it's like, how can it be that much, you know, greater?
Sure. Hey, George, we're going to take our first break here. Be right back in a couple minutes. This is Money Talk, 5:06 a.m.
To enjoy a longer, productive retirement, you need an investment portfolio that continues to work for you. Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management specializes in solid financial advice. Whether you require low volatility, liquid assets, or longer-term investments for higher returns, it's important to discuss your options with a financial advisor. Schedule a consultation with Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management today. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Carson Partners, a division of CWM LLC, is a nationwide partnership of advisors.
Ra, ra, ah, 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 rum, ah, rum, ma, ga, ga, ooh, la, la, what's your bad romance?
Hey, Yuma, this is Money Talk. Tom Rush here, and we got a guest on today, George, who's involved with the University of Arizona, and he's involved in the research side of ag. And so at the Ag Summit, George, you mentioned you're going to be revealing some numbers from a kind of a new report that came out.
Yeah, we have numbers. Again, we did a kind of statewide report, and we've also done a Yuma-specific report. So I'm going to talk a little bit about both of those.
Okay.
George, I've got a question. You know, we've been talking about, like, the efficiencies and the amount of monies and all, and that stuff is great, and I think people expect that of Yuma. The professionalism here has gone on forever, and the research keeps making it better. One issue, though, the reason we talk about water is because it's scarce. We talk about water because everybody wants more. And I know we're putting ourselves in a place to where we show that we're more worthy because we do more with it. We're more productive. We give more back to the state and taxes and income back to the state. But isn't there also conversations about finding more water versus just discussion of distributing the drops that we have?
Yeah, there are, but getting other supplies. I mean, again, it's like they passed legislation, you know, to try to go. Basically, they allocated, you know, $1 billion over a 3-year period, and 75% of that was supposed to go and look for, you know, water elsewhere, and you know. You know, and some of the ideas are quite frankly wacky, like let's pump the stuff from the Mississippi River.
But it sounds fun.
Stuff from, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, let's pump stuff down from, you know, the Columbia Basin in Washington. Yeah. Let's bring in icebergs, you know, down to L.A. and ship it.
I have heard that. And
Of all the, you know, these ideas, you know, with, you know, supply augmentation, kind of the least zany one, because the problem with all those other things, it's like, well, they go, oh, we'll get it from the Mississippi River. Well, a couple of years ago, the Mississippi River was getting so low that barge traffic was getting messed up. You know, you go up to, you know, the Columbia Basin in the Pacific Northwest, and I've told farmer groups, he goes like, well, there's farmers up there. And they have pickup trucks and remote locations and digging equipment and shotguns. So you go up there and talk about taking their water away. So that's the thing. I mean, getting the water from someplace else means, like, usually it means taking it away from farmers someplace else. Now, the one thing that's an exception to that is there's been talk about doing, like, a desalination plant in Mexico, and then shipping the water up to Arizona from there. But that the water one to get all the approvals to get that through would take 30 years, kind of in the best of times. And you're kind of assuming that all, like, political relationships between the U.S. and Mexico are really smooth, which is definitely not the case right now. And then even if you got it through all the approval process and did all the logistics of building it, it's like $2,500 an acre foot.
Oh.
You know, so I'm already kind of showing you that it's like, well, Yuma's making $1,500 an acre foot gross. Right. Yeah. And it's like, well, this water costs $2,500 an acre foot. So they're looking at, you know, augmenting supplies, but right now it's just not economical.
Yeah. But there's a lot more to be done. I mean, we could build more reservoirs in California, particularly. We could have desalination on the California borders, which borders the ocean, by the way, and
yeah,
we have access. But those are big projects and takes big coordination, which I know we don't have currently. But if we don't, I know these projects take time, but if we don't start on it, we'll never have them.
Yeah. And I know there's been more talk about, like with reservoirs, you know, an alternative to building new ones is to like basically either you know, make the height of existing ones higher or go down deeper to augment them.
Yeah.
Arizona's also done things with like managed aquifer recharge. You know, when we had for a while we had more Colorado River water than we could actually use, and we were putting it underground.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what's interesting is there's parts of central Arizona where, you know, the water table had been going down and now it's kind of backed up and because of these recharge programs. And so, you know, things like that are good ideas. Yeah, no, you're right. Anytime you, you know, it's like one of those, like, what should we do for water? And I think the right answer is usually all of the above. Try getting more supply and not just cutting back. You know, but there's kind of what you could do technologically, and then there's just what's economically feasible. And right now, a lot of the augmentation stuff's really expensive. You know, and as you say, like for desal, like in California, they're exploring that. And as the technology for desal gets better, you know, you expect to move down that cost curve. So that may change in the future.
So I know Israel's doing it. Mm-hmm. Is it expensive to have water over in Israel compared to the States?
Yeah, I mean, they can do it, but it's, you know, it's expensive. And so that's the thing. It's like you can get water, but you're going to pay a high price for it.
Sure.
And again, as I said, there are parts of the basin, and they're grossing $200 an acre foot, not net. I mean, some of these areas they're like zero. They're like breaking even, and so it's a question of, well, you know, do you know you don't. I wouldn't recommend taking water from those folks, but if you know you offer to pay them to part with it. You know, there's a lot of folks who are going to part with it at $200 an acre foot or less, and that might be a cheaper way than building something that's, you know, $2,500 an acre foot.
Sure. So how about this this new report coming out? I know you don't want to talk too much about it since you're going to be the speaker about it,
uh-huh.
But is there anything you can tell us that is kind of juicy about it that you can let us know today?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing, again, I was saying before that, you know, I look at these like human numbers and it's like, is this right? And so like one of the things we did is, right, everybody likes rankings, right? You look at like, you know, college football or college basketball, you want to know how your team ranks. So like for vegetable production, Yuma is in the top 0.1%. So that means their sales of veggies is, you know, more than 99.9% of the counties in the U.S. For like all crop production, they're in the top 0.4%, which again, like not just vegetables, but for, you know, if you put all crops combined, Yuma's more than 99.6. In terms of all ag products, both crops and livestock, Yuma's in the top 1%. And then, you know, so, and again, Yuma is famous for their veggies, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a second, but Yuma's in the top quarter in cotton production in the whole U.S. across counties. And you think of all those counties, like big counties in Texas, across the Mississippi Delta growing cotton, Yuma's in the top quarter. Yuma's also in the top third in grain and oilseed production. And again, think of all that corn, you know, when you say grain and oil seeds, that's corn and soybeans and wheat. So if you look all across the Corn Belt, if you ever driven across Iowa, it's like it looks like those old things in plays where people have the background and you just rotate the same background around and around, you're going past corn, soybean, you know, as far as the eye can see. And, you know, if you think, and I think like 70% of the land mass in the Corn Belt is either corn or soybean. So if you think of all those counties and all those counties in the Great Plains growing wheat, in that category, Yuma is still in the top third, even though, you know, they're growing grains in rotation with veggies. So, you know, Yuma is just kind of off the charts in terms of, you know, national production.
Sure.
You know, another thing is that a thing that I didn't quite appreciate, you know, you hear about Yuma being like the winter vegetable capital. And it's certainly true, like, you know, that – and when I first came to Arizona, I thought, oh, winter vegetables. So I thought literally it was the 3 months of winter where so much of it came from Yuma. And it's really – I've heard people say from, like, something like from Thanksgiving to Easter, 90% of the stuff comes from Yuma. Some of it – people kind of lump in Yuma with the Imperial Valley and Coachella – Coachella Valley.
Sure.
But it's actually kind of from Veterans Day, so right in the middle of November to the end of April, almost everything comes from Yuma, the Imperial Valley, and the Coachella Valley. If you're eating, you know, you're eating salad or leafy greens, that's where it's coming from. And so when winter, it's like, okay, from, you know, middle of November to the end of April, that's just more, that's a lot more than three winter months. That's almost half the year.
Sure. Yeah. So I think like you said, Arizona's might know this, humans might know this, but is there anything to do to like educate more states on this, or do you think it's
I mean, again, like the University of Arizona has like offices in, you know, Washington, and I know they're trying to take, you know, convey this information to them. And I've been at different meetings where, you know, kind of people, you know, think of this. It's like, okay, you've got like all these vegetables coming from, you know, a real small area. You know, if you look at, you know, even if you took like, you know, here's Yuma County, Imperial County, Riverside County, you know, and you look at like Google Earth, the part that's green is just a small share of that county.
Yeah.
So you've got a huge amount of our vegetables coming from a really, really small area. And so, you know, some people have said, well, this is kind of like a national security issue too.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of raising that awareness. I know at, you know, the university has been, you know, pushing on that.
I see. There's not too much produce coming out of Texas, is there?
Some. I mean, California is the big dog.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's all these categories. It's funny if you look, it's like Yuma is second in this, Yuma is second in that, Yuma is second, or Arizona is second, and you're saying, well, it's really Yuma in a lot of these veggies, and they're second to California. But, you know, an interesting thing is if you look at like lettuce shipments,
because I guess the point I'm trying to make is there's probably not too many places that can grow produce, right, with the water and the climate and all that.
No, that's another thing. Yuma is very, very unique. They have this. Well, they have the climate, which is ideal. They've got the water right there. Right, you just pull it off the river, and they've got the labor supply.
Yep, and good soil.
So, yep. Good, yeah, and so like Florida, they have disasters, they have floods, they have hurricanes, and they have labor issues, and
probably humidity too is probably not good for some of that.
Yeah, right? But you know, like people, you know, Arizona's had E-Verify for like since like 2008 to kind of verify whether people are working here legally.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of states don't, you know, aren't E-Verify states. Arizona bit the bullet early family and did that. And, you know, people come across every morning from San Luis into Yuma, and then they go back. So they're kind of commuting back and forth.
Right.
And having that kind of, like, stable, close, legal labor supply, and it, 'cause people have been doing it year after year, they're experienced. And again, with produce, everybody goes to the grocery store and you look at produce, and if it doesn't look good, people don't buy it. So the people who harvest it have to, know what they're doing. And so one of the advantages Arizona has over places like Florida is that
good labor.
We have good labor. Yeah.
I see.
And that's another thing other parts of the Colorado Basin don't have. You know, once you start heading north, they have labor supply issues.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't think about it that way.
Actually, I think for Arizona, labor availability is more of a threat than water availability.
No.
Because you can't grow the high value crops if you don't have that labor supply.
Correct.
See,
you never hear about that. You always hear about the water, but a good point about the labor.
Well, that's the thing. What's the value of your water if there's nobody to harvest a crop?
Yeah.
It goes to zero.
Yeah.
And again, because you have that, you have a legal, experienced, skilled labor supply that just comes across, every morning.
Correct. Well, and that's also good for the border towns, because I'm sure that their paychecks get cashed and the money goes right back down to them and they spend it. So,
yeah.
Hey, we're going to take another break here. This is Money Talk 560 AM. Be back in a minute.
Given recent events in the financial markets, doesn't a second opinion make sense for your financial well-being? If you've been questioning your investment plan that you have in place, Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management would like to help by offering a free, no-obligation consultation to review your financial affairs. Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Carson Partners, a division of CWM LLC, is a nationwide partnership of advisors.
At Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management, they believe they manage money for their clients differently from many other advisors in Yuma. Their way works in close alignment with their clients' goals. Yuma Investment Group is a fiduciary. At Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management, they believe they manage money for their clients differently from many other advisors in Yuma. Their way works in close alignment with their clients' goals. Yuma Investment Group is a fiduciary, obligated to put clients first. It's the highest standard for a financial advisor. When it comes to helping clients pursue a comfortable retirement, they're clearly different. Visit YumaInvestmentGroup.com and find out why investors switch to them. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
Hey, Yuma, this is Money Talk. We got our guest on the line, George, who's going to be the guest speaker out at Ag Summit, which is about 2.5 weeks out at the college. And we're talking about ag in Arizona and ag in Yuma. So it's interesting, on break, I was thinking about your comment about the labor being, an issue if it doesn't come into play. But I think in the next, 10, 15 years with robotics and all that, the labor problem could be solved or less people can be used if we got robotics. But on the waterfront, how are you going to substitute for water, right? You can't.
No, it's very hard. I mean, what was it? Do you remember the musical Oklahoma? There's a song where they goes, they've gone about as fur as they can go.
Fur. Yeah, it sounds like Oklahoma.
Yeah, and it's in terms of efficiency, we're really pushing the envelope. But again, Yuma, over the last 30 years, they grew a lot more, field crops. And there was a shift towards, one of the reasons you have this high value per acre foot is the shift towards the higher value veggie crops. Another thing that was done was if you look at time maps of when the crops are actually in the ground, it's shifted. So there's less crop in the ground in the hottest months of the year, and there's more crop in the ground during cooler months. And just kind of doing that shift has been another way of, you know, getting more water. That's the thing, you know, growers are always looking to, you know, conserve things.
Sure.
And, you know, because it's a cost, right? Yeah. And that's the thing. I think a lot of people will say, oh, farmers are using all this. And it's like farmers want to use as little as they can get away with because everything they use costs.
Yeah, they pay for it. Yeah.
Have you done any studies on growing plants in, like, buildings?
You mean like vertical farming?
Yeah, vertical farming. Is that not effective yet? Or
not so much. I mean, that's the thing, like, about – well – actually, when people come, they go, well, we're going to do greenhouses. We're going to do vertical farming. And like, the first question I have is your price point kind of going to come in under Yuma?
No.
No. And that's the thing. I mean, Yuma is like this ideal environment. It's not enclosed, but it's like you've got a kind of stable water right there. You've got stable labor right there. You've got how many days of stable sunshine right there. It's almost like a perfect lab environment already.
Vertical farming is going to have a nice niche, and it does have a nice niche in inner cities and things on top of buildings where it's going to produce enough crop for a one block area, for a building, for a restaurant, and there's no transportation costs and all that. But it's not going to be for mass production like we do in Yuma.
No. And I think, you know, and again, it's this question of, can you do it technologically? Yes.
Yeah.
Can you do it economically? There is a study that this British research team was doing something where they were growing a crop. I forget what the crop was, but it was something that was not particularly labor intensive, and they were going to try to do the entire thing from beginning to end, just with machines.
Mm.
So they would have, you know, like robots go in and you know, hoe it. They have robots go in and plant the seeds and apply the fertilizer and apply the pesticides and, you know, then harvest the crop. And I think they got, like, you know, half the crop that you would get under normal production conditions. But to me, that's actually a promising start.
Yep. More and more automation is coming. We know that.
Yes. Yeah. No, I was actually at a conference a couple of years ago. It was actually University of Nebraska, and it was kind of like the future of agriculture. And we all had to go around the table, and it's like, what are people going to be saying in 20 years? And I piped up, and I was the only one that said this. I said, in 20 years, the big news headline will be mechanization is back.
I think you're right. Yeah.
And as you point out, there's this labor issue. And again, the trick with, you know, a lot of this is that it takes a certain amount of discernment, right, to harvest things without damaging it. But I think we're going to see like a lot more mechanization. Well, we've already seen, like, with drones.
Well, like and that was going to be one of my questions with drones, and I know you're familiar that they're doing more and more with drones on checking the condition of crops. They can take pictures and find out if it's getting enough water, too much water, fertilization, and all that. They can get that from drones and all that. But I also heard they're doing drones to actually do fertilization.
They're doing drones to do fertilization, and they're doing drones to apply pesticides. And that's the thing, when you're applying pesticides, right, especially if you're doing it, you know, around, like, urban areas where there are any kind of population, you know, people don't want to see the crop duster flying overhead.
Right.
And again, one, it's not so great for the environment to have stuff volatilizing and floating around. But at the same time, from the farmers, it's like, well, I'm paying for all this stuff that's not getting on the crop.
Yeah.
And so by targeting you know, being more precise, you're going to be using fewer pesticides, and they're going to be, you know, like going where they're supposed to be going and not going where they're not supposed to be going.
Exactly. I've seen some of them, and they're not going to cover the big swaths like a $2 million aircraft that swoops through at, you know, 40 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. But it's so precise, and they can work all night. They don't care.
Yeah. And then, again, another thing is controlling weeds. Because we've had, you know, once upon a time, you know, weeding was everything, you know, was people had hoes, and that's how things were done. And from like the 1950s on, when herbicides came on, and they just like took over as a production practice. And most, when they say, well, pesticide use, most pesticide use in the U.S., the vast majority isn't for insects. It's actually for weeds.
Right, herbicides and, more, yeah.
Yeah, herbicide, yeah, or like the biggest like ag chemical use is herbicide. So it's to control weeds, not to control insects.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that's happened is that as you use the herbicide, there's things called modes of action, which are ways that the particular herbicide kills the weed. The weeds evolve resistance to it over time. And so what would happen is that, you know, they would apply a particular kind of compound and it would work for a while. And then the weeds would, you know, adapt. And so it didn't work again.
Makes sense.
The chemical companies would develop a new thing. And it was always this race. Well, then we went 40 years without any new mode of action.
Okay.
And so the kinds of chemicals that would actually work, you know, in farmers' portfolio of what they could use was, you know, has been dwindling. And so now we're starting to see this move toward mechanization where you're going to, you know, and there's things where, you know, I kind of nerdy. I think it's cool. Like you'll see these like little like crawling robots, you know, and they'll burn the weeds.
Yeah.
Or they will like zap it with electricity, or they will just yank it out. I saw one thing that looked like this metal claw hand, and it was going past baby lettuce in Salinas in California, and it had sensors, and the thing was going along, and you know it was like not touching the lettuce, but as soon as there was a weed, the thing just snagged it.
With a mechanical claw or something, a trowel.
With a mechanical claw. And, it would just go through. And so, and then they have things now where I'm working on another project looking at these things you put on the back of harvesters that destroy the seeds. So if the weeds are resistant, it doesn't matter because we're gonna destroy the seeds. So it's not going to stay in the seed bank in the crop.
That would be through steam, wouldn't it? I've seen some on steam where they're actually using steam to purify the land of seeds.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
This technology actually came, the Australians developed it. There's a thing, the Seed Destructor, and they actually, it was based on mining equipment.
Hmm.
And it was like this technology, it was like a mill that would like crunch up rock.
Okay.
Huh. And they took like a variant of that, and they put it like on the back of a harvester, and we're doing this, you know, for seeds for wheat. And then they're working on that technology here. And so I think, again, there's concern about use of ag chemicals and, again, labor supply, you know, harvesting stuff, pulling weeds, you know, is really labor intensive. No one really wants to do that. And so I think we're going to see, you know, a lot more mechanization in weed control. And we'll see.
More and more people want the organic type grown, chemical-free products. So I think the marketplace is more and more leaning towards that and pushing it.
Yeah. And another development which is interesting is that over time, you know, buyers of agricultural commodities want, you know, to have these environmental standards on how the crops are being produced. So growers traditionally would have to respond to, okay, here are various EPA regulations for health and safety, you know, that we have to follow. But now companies like food processing companies are kind of going to you know, farms and say, well, we want to be able to put this like sustainability like label on it, and we want you to do these particular things. And so that's kind of, you know, to get those contracts, those are things where they're extra hoops that growers are going to have to jump through, yeah. You know, and they're looking for ways. It's like, well, how can we demonstrate that we're doing things sustainably?
Well, and they're business guys, and it's fun to listen to them, because the guys in Yuma aren't, well, this is the way Daddy did it, and I'm going to do it. No, these guys are they like the innovations in Yuma anyway. And it's always enjoyable to be around the farming community here. They talk about the future as much as the past.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's interesting because there is this, like, we have this traditional way of doing things, but farmers have always liked to experiment on stuff, you know, and they'll try something out. They'll, you know, like, okay, I've got X number of acres. Here's one field. I'm going to try this, you know, and if something works, you know, they hop on it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very innovative, but yeah, they're willing to, you know, they're willing to test something out on a small scale. You know, and if it looks like it's going to fly, they'll embrace it. And we saw this with like genetically modified crops. You know, you sort of like, oh, farmers are losing all this money doing it. It's like, well, no, it's like, why are people are adopting this stuff? Because it works.
There's been a pushback on genetically modified. I guess maybe it's misunderstood. Maybe it's, you know, unnecessary fears or whatever, but. There's also a push, you know, where it's, you know, no, I don't want anything in my food that's genetically altered or genetically pushed around.
Yeah.
So I would assume that that's, you know, organics, non-NGOs are something I know there's a big market for, and so farmers have to be looking at all that.
I mean, there's a market for it, and there's premiums for that, but again, it's a question of, you know, the vast majority of consumers, when they go into a grocery store, they look at price.
Yeah, I know.
You know, and again, you go to the grocery store, and again, now, you know, you go to the grocery section, there's a lot of organic stuff out there.
There are. It's surprising to me. I didn't know it would grow as fast as it did.
Yeah, and then, you know, but again, it's, you know, and it's more expensive, and it's a question of some people want to pay that much more. And some people don't, you know, and another, you know, aspect of like the resistance to GMOs, it's like in Europe, you had this weird kind of coalition of like consumer and environmental groups that didn't like GMOs and the farmers, because GMOs gave North America more of an advantage over Europe in production.
Yeah.
It kind of heightened the advantage they had. And so it's like, well, like the farmers in Europe, it's like, yeah, let's keep this out.
And they did. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of the crops we do are not legal in
yeah. And that's a challenge for growers. You know, if you're trying to grow a crop and it's like, well, I can sell, if I produce it this way, I can sell into this market, but not into that market. And it's just like one of the extra complexities that growers have to deal with is not just, you know, can I produce that crop, but where can I send it after it's done?
Well, yeah, we found that out about hemp.
Mm-hmm.
When hemp was legal again, there was a big push to grow it. And I know a lot of people were selling it, and I know people that were lobbying for it. But there wasn't anybody buying it because we didn't have any textile mills ready to take it on.
Yeah,
so it's going to have to grow slowly, and they'll have to build an infrastructure before we get back to that.
Right. Well, and we'll get that. You know, I'm in the Department of Ag and Resource Economics at the University of Arizona, and I'm in Extension. And every once in a while, someone will call up, and they're like, well, what's the cost of producing carrots in Maricopa County? You know, we have like crop, this is like what it would cost. And like a first question is, well, who are you going to sell it to?
Correct. And that needs to be the question. Like, absolutely.
And it's like, oh, well, we hadn't thought about that. And it's like, well, you're going to have all these carrots that are ripe and ready to go in Maricopa County where it's hot. It better go someplace soon. And that's the thing. Like, you know, Yuma has all those markets lined up.
Right.
And, you know, what's interesting, if you look at like lettuce consumption in the U.S. It's constant, right? You ever go to the grocery store and there not be lettuce?
No.
It's always like uniform high quality and it's always there. But if you look at lettuce shipments from November to April, it's all coming out of, you know, Yuma and Imperial and Coachella. And then once it starts to get hot in May, that all shuts down and it all moves to Salinas.
Right.
And the production looks like a sine wave that overlaps. So the top is always constant, but you have this system that is kind of like turning literally on a dime, where it ramps up one place, shuts down another place. And we're spoiled.
Is there much produce?
Doesn't miss a beat.
Is there much produce coming from, or lettuce coming from South America?
No. I mean, other stuff from...
It's got such a short shelf life. You know, it's a tough one.
We're just so good at it. I mean, there's some, a tiny bit, but not...
The pricing probably
not much.
More expensive, so it's harder to...
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that's like coming from Mexico are things like... a lot of tomatoes come from Mexico, you know, a lot of berries. You know, and again, you've got like the tropical stuff, like, you know, right. Bananas and coffee that we just can't grow here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but Yuma and Salinas are just so productive at growing lettuce. There really isn't like a place on the planet any better at doing it.
Sure. Now you're going to be speaking and I think you said February 18th. Out at the college?
I'm going to be speaking February 20th, but 20th. The Ag Summit, it's a three-day summit with different activities. It starts on the 18th, the last day is the 20th, and I'll be speaking on the 20th. But okay. It starts up on the 18th.
If any listeners want to buy a ticket, because I know that you guys serve lunch when you speak, they could probably Google it and look at the Southwest Ag Conference in Yuma.
Yeah, Google Southwest Ag Summit.
Okay, good.
And you will find the information about that.
Now, are you going to be there for the 3 days or just for one day? Or
I'm going to be there. I'm going to be in Yuma on the 19th, 20th, and there's other follow-on stuff on the 21st. I'm not going to be there because I'm running around doing other stuff, and then I'm going to hit Yuma. Yeah, but I'm going to be there for not all of it, but for most of it.
Okay, good. And then next week, we're also going to have on one of your co-workers. You want to say briefly what she does so the listeners might tune in for next week?
Sure. Yeah, so Dari Duvall is my colleague. She's worked on a number of these projects looking at ag contributions. One of the things she did was actually kind of track down, you know, people talk about how much – you know, produce comes out of Yuma in winter months. And she actually like went through like weekly data files from the Ag Marketing Service of USDA to kind of, you know, put numbers up and do that. But I'm kind of the pretty face. She's one of the people that does all the,
she's the workhorse.
Get out and talk to folks on talk radio. But she does a lot of the actual number crunching.
I see. Well, good. Well, you look forward to that. And sorry to cut you off here, but our time is up. And I appreciate you coming on. And we'll hope to have you on maybe next year when we get closer to the Ag Summit, too.
That'd be great. Thanks much.
Yep. Thanks. Thank you. Bye. Yep.
At Yuma Investment Group Wealth Management, they believe they manage money for their clients differently from many other advisors in Yuma. Their way works in close alignment with their clients' goals. Yuma Investment Group is a fiduciary, obligated to put clients first. It's the highest standard for a financial advisor. When it comes to helping clients pursue a comfortable retirement, they're clearly different. Visit YumaInvestmentGroup.com and find out why investors switch to them. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
The opinions voiced in Money Talk with Tom Rush and George Davis Wealth are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine what may be appropriate for you, consult with your attorney, accountant, financial or tax advisor prior to investing. Guests on Money Talk are not affiliated with CWM LLC. Investment advisory services offered through CWM LLC and SEC Registered Investment Advisor.
Scanning through the bathroom window, had to buy a silver spoon. But now she sucks up fun and wonders how the banks over on the lagoon.
This is News Talk 560 KBLU, Yuma.